Mr. Chairman, dear friends, it's first of all a very great pleasure for me to be able to visit the historical city of Beijing, Pekin, different names that we used when I was a child and heard the name of this great city. I had an uncle who was ambassador here at the time of Sun Yat-sen. It's been a long time since my family has come back to China. Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be able to participate in this very important forum. My discourse will be very different from that of my predecessor, Thomas Professor Arrow, because I'm not an economist. I'm a philosopher, and I shall try to deal with the issue of the harmony of heaven, earth, and civilizations from the philosophical point of view. I have a paper which is entitled Harmony of Heaven, Earth, and Man, Harmony of Civilizations. Anyone seriously concerned with the human condition today cannot but observe the presence of unprecedented crises and disorder on so many planes of our existence, from the spiritual, philosophical, and psychological, to the social, economic, and political, to the environmental that now threatens the very web of life here on Earth, including our own. Instead of seeking that harmony between heaven, earth, and man, use the terminology of classical Chinese tradition, which has its correspondence in other major traditions of humanity, from the Hindu and Buddhist to the Christian and Islamic. So many today seek to live in disregard of this inner harmony. And there are even those who go so far as to deny that such a thing is even possible or has any meaning. Ours is a world dominated by self-interest of individuals, ethnic entities, economic groupings and nations. We speak often of humanity, but usually only in an abstract sense. And when we do seek to be unselfish, it is usually in making our interests subservient to those of the group, organization, or nation to which we belong, and not to humanity as a whole. There being some exceptions that are still, however, very much a minority voice. One can, of course, claim that it has always been and will therefore continue to be so. But such an assertion overlooks the radically challenged situation in which we now live, one that requires our extending our view of us to embrace ultimately the whole of humanity. Before modern means of communication and production disrupted traditional patterns of life, brought different segments of humanity closer to each other in an unprecedented manner, and caused the actions of people in one part of the world to affect virtually all parts. Before the radioactive clouds of Chernobyl killed people in Lapland in Sweden, and the carbon emission of one country caused devastating floods in lands far away, for men and women of one segment of humanity, their world was the world. 1,000 years ago, for a Chinaman, China was for all practical purposes the world as such, and Chinese society, humanity itself. The same was also true, mutatis mutandis, for a Muslim, a Christian, or Hindu. There were seers and sages who did have a global vision of humanity, but for the vast majority, such a vision seemed only theoretical and did not concern their practical lives in a concrete fashion. Nor did it need to do so, except in rare cases. Even religions addressed a particular humanity for which they had been destined as humanity as such. Few members of each civilization, for the members of each civilization, the civilization was civilization pure and simple. And those outside of it were often treated as uncivilized, barbarians, unbelievers, etc. Into this natural order of things came modern Western civilization, which had not only sought to monopolize for itself the condition of being civilized, and did so in a new totalitarian manner, but also attempted to destroy other civilizations in a fundamental way by negating the very legitimacy of any worldview other than its own. As its power spread all over the world, being civilized came to mean, for those who had become subservient to it, no matter where they were living on the globe, being Europeanized, or westernized and modernized. This process itself made it unfashionable and redundant even to speak in modern circles of civilization in the plural. During the colonial period, even opposition to this Western domination by Asians, Africans, and others came usually not in the name of other civilizations and their traditions, but in the form of modern European idea of nationalism. The case of the movement of Mahatma Gandhi in India and some of the anti-colonial movements in the Islamic world being exceptions to the rule. It is therefore quite significant that during the past two decades, partly due to the otherwise flawed thesis of Samuel Huntington, discussion on civilization in the plural, that is civilizations, has again become prevalent. It is indeed significant that we now speak of civilizations, the importance of their harmonious existence, and the dangers inherent in their possible confrontations. To speak in these terms is to realize already the truth that despite its worldwide spread, Western civilization has not been able to destroy until now, nor is likely to do so in the future, the other major civilizations of the world. And the world views or presiding ideas that have created various civilizations. In fact, as a result of major crises within Western civilization itself, many in the West have now become deeply attracted to the philosophies, religions, arts, social teachings, and even sciences and technologies of other civilizations, which were considered as being irrelevant by so many until recently. Much has been written in the West itself on the basis of unprecedented access to the sources of the wisdom of other civilizations, and driven often by the search for truths largely lost as a consequence of the triumph of modernism in the West, about the remarkable similarity in the teachings of various wisdom traditions, including that of the traditional West, the wisdom to which many of us refer as the Sophia Perennis or the Philosophia Perennis. Furthermore, on the basis of these teachings, many have come to understand the deeper reasons for the crisis of modernism, chief among them being what can be called the rebellion against heaven, to use a Chinese term, and consequently, the loss of harmony with the earth. They have come to realize how the spread of the modern worldview has resulted in unprecedented conflicts on so many levels, in the rise of individualism against the weakening of the social order, in the spread of psychological imbalance among so many members of modern society, in the unprecedented environmental crisis with terrifying consequences for the future of all humanity if the crisis is allowed to continue, in the weakening of the moral order individually and collectively, in the unprecedented disparity between the rich and the poor, in the existence of abject material poverty amidst economic prosperity for some, in the injustice of the so-called global political order, which in reality is a disorder based on the domination by force of the weak by the strong, and in so many other problems whose solutions are vital to humanity as a whole. It does not take a prophet to foresee that the solution of so many of our predicaments lies in the creation of harmony between and within our civilizations. Harmony between civilizations is, however, not possible without harmony between heaven, earth, and man, between Tian, Ti, and Zhen in classical Chinese, within the being of each of us to the extent possible in the chaotic world in which we live. We must reestablish moral order within ourselves. And on the basis of the world, on that basis in the world about us. Remembering what is written in the Analects of Confucius, he who rules by moral force, Te, is like the pole star, which remains in its place while all the lesser stars do homage to it. Except that now the arena of our moral actions must be humanity and, in fact, creation as a whole. Our vision of such a global order must moreover be based not on the espousal of relativism and a secularist humanism based on the ever-shifting sands of terrestrial human nature and the destruction of our own traditions in the name of the bland least common denominator between our cultures, but on the true nature of man and, of course, woman, which is fundamental to all of our traditions and has confirmed the perennial philosophy long at the heart of our wisdom traditions. To what we can justly call unanimous tradition. The task of those who possess this global and at the same time universal vision is to seek harmony based on mutual respect between different civilizations on the basis of the reestablishment of first within ourselves and then within the being of those we are able to lead to this vision of harmony with both heaven and earth. Without the establishment of this inner harmony, our discussions about the harmony between civilizations cannot but remain mere talk. Mere talk. The creation of a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, to reformulate the famous lines of Shakespeare. Man is a thinking being, and how he thinks usually determines how he acts. Let us then mention a few concrete ideas that can play a crucial role in how we can act in trying to achieve that harmony between civilizations we all seek. The present de facto interconnectedness between different individuals, societies, and civilizations requires us to go beyond all parochialism. We must re-examine what we consider to be our ethnic, national, cultural, and even civilizational interests in light of the inevitable role that the interests of the other can and does have for our own ultimate interests. We must realize that every other civilization also considers itself as the Middle Kingdom, to use the classical Chinese concept, and that center where heaven and earth meet exists in one form or another for the other as it does for us. We must respect the integrity of other civilizations in the precious truth and realities they bear within themselves, no matter how different they might be on the outward plane from what we consider to be ours. In this context, one should recall the wise words of the ancient Chinese sage Confucius again. In his Analects, he says, "The man of perfect virtue, Jen, wishing to be established himself, seeks also to establish others. Wishing to enlarge himself, he seeks to enlarge others." In light and on the basis of this mutual respect, all of those who seek harmony between civilizations must oppose the establishment of the global order based on purely material factors and bent on destroying the precious diversity of human civilizations and cultures. Harmony, after all, presumes the existence of diversity, without whose destruction results not in harmony, but in a deadening uniformity that can only impoverish humanity and be most destructive for the rich spiritual heritage that we have received from our traditions. We must seek to revive the idea of what the eminent Chinese Confucian scholar and philosopher Tu Wei Ming, I don't know whether he is here or not, has called anthropocosmic man. This idea is profoundly Chinese, but it is not only Chinese. Rather, it has its correspondence in other cultures. According to this thesis, taught by all of our wisdom traditions, man is not just an island unto himself, a subject who creates his own objective reality. Rather, his true nature binds him to an objective world that has its ontological reality independent of his subjectivism. And his being includes an organic link to both the society in which he lives, an idea that has been so much influenced and by and emphasized in classical Chinese thought, and also to humanity as a whole. It also includes the profound relation to the world of nature and the fact that the whole of cosmic reality, with both heaven and earth, of classical Chinese cosmology. The revival of awareness within us of the reality of the anthropocosmic man as our true nature should have direct consequences for us for how we act on every basis in our lives. It means the recreation of balance between ourselves and the natural world that surrounds us. It means the regaining of a state of naturalness of which classical Far Eastern schools such as Chan or Zen in Japan have spoken so eloquently. It means a new understanding of the boundaries with which we define ourselves as individuals, societies, nations, and even civilizations, of how we see ourselves in relation to others, to all those whom we consider as others, on the basis of the inner harmony attained through the realization of this naturalness, which is the antipode of giving free rein to what we call our natural instincts. We can then seek harmony with the society in which we live and create an economic and political order based not on simply on selfishness, greed, aggression, and domination, but on harmony in relation to the other based on integrity and the preservation of wholeness. Let us not forget that harmony is based on the existence of plurality. One cannot create musical harmony if one can play only a single note. Uniformity that destroys all pluralism does not result in a life of harmony, but leads to the monotony of death. The harmony between civilizations and also with the world of nature of which we speak so often these days, and whose realization has now become not only a far-fetched ideal, but a matter of life and death for humanity, implies forming a new attitude towards pluralism, whether it be concerned with the ethnic, the religious, the cultural, the social, or the civilizational, and ultimately with even non-human forms of life. Moreover, this pluralism must be understood not as what those philosophers who defend modernism consider as so-called universalism, that is based on sheer relativism and denial of all truth claims. This is but a pseudo-universalism that cannot but lead to intellectual suicide. The pluralism of which I speak is itself based on the truth and means clinging to the truth of our own tradition while respecting the other and without denying that there is such a thing as error. If there is no truth, there is no error. And if there is no goodness, there is no evil. As far as civilizations are concerned, authentic pluralism means cultivating respect for other civilizations and honoring the way of life, thought, culture, and actions of others, even if they be different from our own. It requires cultivation of the attitude of cooperation rather than aggression and domination. Surely there cannot be harmony between those who are aggressors and those who seek to dominate by force, and those who are subjects of aggression and domination. In speaking of harmony between civilizations, it is necessary to mention also the significance of harmony within civilization. Rarely in history have there been civilizational wars and confrontations. Most discord has come between nations, tribes, and ethnic groups within a single civilization, and even between the alliance of elements belonging to two different civilizations against other alliances of groups belonging to the two civilizations in question. Our histories are replete with such occurrences, as for example when the Ottomans and the Safavids, belonging to Islamic civilization, made alliances with different European powers, such as the French, the British, and the Austro-Hungarians, all belonging to Western civilization, with the aim of gaining the upper hand in the confrontation with each other. Some, in fact, have criticized the whole thesis of the clash of civilizations on the basis of this historical and also present-day reality. But they are wrong, as far as this particular criticism is concerned. For civilizations remain powerful realities, even if there does not exist harmony among various nations and diverse groups within them. If we do not exert our efforts to create that harmony, conditions are such that the world could in fact move towards confrontations of colossal dimensions between civilizations themselves. Already those who speak of the West and the rest are propagating civilizational confrontation. We must therefore seek both inner and intra-civilizational harmony here and now. To achieve this harmony, both among ourselves and with others, we must cultivate a holistic view of life, a vision that is deeply embedded in our wisdom traditions, no matter to which civilization we belong. Each of our traditions must in fact bring all its spiritual resources to bear upon the solution of the unprecedented crisis that humanity now faces. And each of our civilizations has a particular contribution to making possible the realization of this goal that concerns us all. We must also strengthen our organic bond, not only our own social group, not only with minorities living among us, whether they be of an ethnic, racial, linguistic, or religious nature, not only with the rest of our civilization with whom we share profound commonalities, but also with the people belonging to other civilizations, with the whole of humanity. We must be ever mindful that the heaven with which man must be in harmony is symbolized by the sky that covers us all, and the earth with which we must seek to live in peace is the one upon which we all walk. A situation has been created in these times in which the awareness of this holistic vision is no longer only an ideal of a few seers and visionaries, as it has always been, but an imperative reality without whose realization we must face impending disaster collectively. Nowhere is this more evident than in the global environmental crisis, where we see so clearly that disorder rather than harmony with the world of nature affects not only those who have created, lived, and act on the basis of this discord, but humanity as a whole. Being the first Muslim to be given the great honor of delivering a keynote speech at this prestigious forum, I find it necessary to say in conclusion a few words about the possibility of harmony between Islamic and Chinese civilizations, which have had such a long historical relation with each other and which possess geographical contiguity. Already during the Sassanid period, the Persian Empire, which later became the major center of Islamic civilization, had profound relation with the Chinese. The Silk Road was even then not only a route on which goods from silk and jade to carpets were transported back and forth, but also a means of communication of ideas and cultural elements, of arts and sciences, and even of religions. Let us not forget that Buddhism first came to China from the eastern province of the Persian Empire. And this exchange in so many domains became even more accentuated with the establishment of Islamic civilization. The city of Kashgar, now in China, was a thriving center of Islamic civilization in its Persianate form. Over the centuries, Chinese painting began to influence the Persian miniature. Chinese astronomers were to be found in Tabriz, and Chinese ones in Beijing. Works on Chinese medicine were translated and paraphrased in Persian. Stories from China appeared in Persian literature, including some of its masterpieces, such as the works of Nizami. Islamic science had some influence on the development of Chinese science. A technology as central as that of production of paper, the word for which in Persian, that is Kaghaz, comes from Chinese, reached the Islamic world from China and was from the Islamic world that it reached Europe. And then there is the whole question of the presence of Muslims in China and the transformation brought about in classical Islamic learning in China in the 17th century through the transformation of a number of seminal Persian texts and their translation into Chinese texts such as those of Abdurrahman Jami and others in the language of New Confucianism. The full account of the historical contact on numerous levels, from technology to astronomy to philosophy, between Islam and China has yet to be written. It is one about which much needs to be said for many reasons, not least of which is that it is one of the most fascinating inter-civilizational contacts in history. Moreover, this long history can play a fundamental role today in the creation of harmony between these two civilizations on the basis of more than expediency. Huntington considers the allegiance or alliance between Islamic and Chinese civilizations to be of the greatest danger to the West. But is this really true? Such an alliance might be against certain interests of the West in Asia and Africa, but surely if you understand the value of harmony of civilizations in the sense noted above, surely such an accord does not need to be at the expense of the destruction of harmonious existence of either civilization with the West itself. In fact, the creation of harmony between any two civilizations cannot but be a benefit to the whole of humanity, as long as it is not created simply for the sake of political and economic interests, and in order to strengthen the hands of those in accord to confront and combat another civilization seen as the common enemy. In light of the reality of the dire situation existing in the world today resulting from consideration of only selfish interests and the domination of the weak by the strong, the vision of intra and inter-civilizational harmony appears to many as simply an illusion and at best a dream. But in fact, it is our only hope for the avoidance of global disaster. To live a life of harmony with both heaven and earth, to realize the organic nexus that binds us to all creation, to seek harmony and peace among ourselves, between our civilizations, and with the natural world. These are our only means of survival as a species, our only means of salvation as real human beings. They are not simply niceties to be spoken of and then forgotten without being put into action in our everyday lives as individuals, societies, and civilizations. As the famous Chinese proverb states, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. As far as the journey to create harmony between civilizations and prosperity in both the spiritual and economic sense are concerned, that single step must of necessity be the creation of harmony within ourselves, harmony with both heaven and earth. Only after having taken that first step can we take the other steps necessary to create harmony both within our civilization and with other civilizations. Upon the success of our endeavor in this task depends the future of our life of humanity here on earth. Let us take this first step and then strive to complete with hope and determination the difficult journey of 1,000 miles that lies ahead, bringing the caravan of our civilization safely home to the terminal point of our journey, wherein is to be found the abode of peace and harmony. Thank you.
谢谢纳斯教授。下一位主旨报告人是美国政治学会主席、美国康奈尔大学教授Peter Kaltzman的研究涉及国际关系理论、比较政治学、政治经济学、世界政治中的安全与文化等领域。近期研究兴趣集中在文明国家的政治问题，包括 公共外交、法律、宗教、大众文化、世界政治中的地区主义、德国政治等等，曾获政治学领域的多项荣誉，并先后当选为美国艺术与科学院院士和美国哲学学会会员。他今天报告的题目是一个多重与多元文明的世界。现在请卡德斯坦教授演讲。